All right, everyone, welcome to this episode of the Atlanta Real Estate Investor. I'm one of your hosts, Spencer Sutton. I've got Matthew Whitaker here with me. And hey, we're excited to have Ian Mendelson with us. So Ian, man, thanks so much for being on the show.
Sure, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've known Ian for a long time. He and I were in a mastermind together. We've talked a lot about buying houses together. So super excited that you're one of our first Atlanta guests.
Glad I could help you out, man. Anyway I can.
So tell us how you got into real estate and tell the audience how you got into real estate and why real estate.
Sure. Well, I moved to Atlanta in 2002 from California, and I moved here to be part of a small pharmaceutical startup company. Did that for about 2.5 years. Didn't go the way I had planned it. So I left that abruptly and I was like, well, what else am I going to do here? Figured I would get into real estate, but I didn't know too much about it. It was something that people were talking about at the time. And when we grew up, my dad had 2 rental properties and we managed those. We always had to go over there and fix things here and there. It wasn't all that glamorous, but I thought, you know what? I still kind of liked it. So I figured if I was going to get into buying and selling houses, I wanted to know as much as I could about it. So I became a home inspector at first to learn how to look at a house. Did that for several months. I wouldn't do it to earn an income necessarily, but just to get as much experience as possible. So I took the course and ran a business doing that for a little bit. And then I started getting my real estate license. And then when I started doing that is when I met a woman who introduced me to my former business partner who owned a Homevestors franchise at the time. He had bought the franchise. He realized it wasn't for his personality. So he went back to being a corporate attorney. So then he had this thing, this franchise that was just kind of fumbling along. And back then, there was a minimum advertising requirement, so he was just pumping money into this thing.
When was this? What year was this?
2005.
Okay.
In May of 2005. So I met him. We met over lunch. We struck an agreement where I would basically just run his business for him. He understood I didn't have a lot of background, but I was a home inspector. I knew how to do that part, and he was okay with me learning on the job. And I'd say that was in May. I went to training in Dallas with Homevestors. They teach as much as they can, but it's not really something you can teach in a classroom setting. And then by August, I was buying and selling enough houses to pay for the advertising and keep us afloat. And then come January of 2006 is when things just started clicking, and I was buying and selling houses on the regular. So that we did that, and then I'd say maybe a year or so later, he made me a full-fledged partner. Within a couple of years after that, I just wound up buying him out. And when his franchise came up for renewal, I stepped on and he stepped off or something like that. I don't remember exactly how it worked, but I've been doing it ever since 2005.
So I'd be curious, you said, I'm going to unpack all this history. You said that your father owned a couple of rental properties. Is there anything you've learned from your dad that you've kind of instituted in your business today?
Yeah, my dad is a retired physician now, but he was a very hands-on guy. So I got to see a lot of the inner workings of the houses, and anytime they called for a repair, he didn't send anyone out there. He went out there and would bring usually myself along, and we would have to go over there and fix it up and take care of it all. So I learned how to be very hands-on. Sometimes to my detriment, I try to be a little too hands-on these days. So anyone who knows me here, they're like, yeah, look at this truck. I look like a maintenance man driving around. If locks need to be changed, I'll do that. If there's a roof leak, I'll go on the roof and take a look at it. Whereas some of my colleagues, they won't step near a screwdriver, won't get near a ladder or anything along those lines.
That was me when I was buying and selling houses. I couldn't do anything.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No, I was about to say, I thought you were saying you were like Ian.
No, you're
the furthest from Ian. Well, you can't do anything.
I was looking for anybody to fix my houses. I definitely couldn't do anything.
I get stuck waiting for the guy to show up. So I just start tinkering and start messing around with it. It's a terrible use of my time, but you know, it happens.
Well, but you've been successful with it. Hard to snub your nose at success. Tell us a little bit about how you think being a home inspector has helped.
Sure. I mean, that was probably one of the best things I did getting into real estate, is because no one can fool you. Like when you're walking through a crawl space, one of the best ones was like learning all about foundation problems and what's an actual foundation problem, what's not a real foundation problem. When you're buying houses at a discount the way we do, you know, you have to be able to explain to people, no, that horizontal crack is not just nothing. It's actually something, because when I go to sell it, someone's going to be asking questions about it. So you have to be able to identify what you're looking at, know if it's like something that you need to get a second pair of eyes on, or if it's something you can kind of figure out, especially with foundation issues, mold issues, that kind of stuff. You just learn to look at the houses and figure out what's just normal wear and tear, what's actually a problem. So I think that's the biggest thing that's helped me.
Yeah, I think that's important because I know that when I first started buying houses, I owned a Homevestor franchise starting in December of 2003. So me and my partner, Roland Beeson, we were literally guessing at what needed to be repaired. And so we would just, yeah, this is going to be $20,000 or more. We really didn't know, but
and Spencer
tried.
And them were hiring out everything, and all they were doing is looking at for new cars and trucks. And right. That was back in the day when, what's the quote you always say, Spencer? Don't confuse a, what is it?
Don't confuse a bull market for brains. that's what I did. I thought,
but you know what? Back then, I was lucky to have learned the business back then because it was hard to make a mistake in 2005 to 2000, the beginning of 2007. Yep. Even if you bought the house wrong, it was okay because the market was appreciating. There was someone else there to buy it. They weren't always like the best buyers and whatnot. But looking back, that's where I think I got the luckiest for sure. There wasn't as much competition as there is now from the larger buyers. And it was just hard to make a mistake. Even if you didn't factor in, you know, all the repairs, it was still okay.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We've all been Homevestor franchisees. I've been a Homevestor franchisee two different times. Ian's always been one. And Spencer had his stint before the great blow up of
2008.
Yeah. 2007, 2008. You know, one of the things they focused on is buying numbers. But one of the things you've always been very thoughtful, Ian, about buying quality, not quantity. Talk a little bit about that and being a patient buyer.
One of the nice things about Homevestors is when you get together for the annual convention, you get to see what works and what doesn't work with other offices throughout the country. And it was amazing that you'd see one guy on stage winning all these awards one year, and then he's gone the next year. So it was really interesting to see how that would happen and how they ran their business, because everyone gets the same types of leads, but how they manage the leads and what they do with them all change as soon as you go on that appointment. To me, it's always been about making sure you buy right and buy a good deal versus a lot of deals. A lot of people said, oh, I bought 10 houses this month. I don't care if I bought one house this month or two houses. Like, the numbers don't mean anything to me in terms of how many. It's all about, am I buying a good deal? Is it a safe investment? Do I think I'm going to have a decent return on it? And then how to get more of those. But I've never been one to chase a bunch of houses and to get caught up in going on stage or having that any sort of praise by the peers and standing out. That's just slow and steady. That's what's worked for me over the years, and I'm just going to stick to it.
I think that's also a lesson for new people that get in. I think the perception is that that is success. And one of the things that I've learned over the years of going to, whether it's a Homevestor conference or going to a property manager conference, which we go to a lot now, is knowing the credible people, when to smell out somebody that's credible, that has good information to give you, and somebody that's basically just telling a story that's not real.
And it's usually the guys who, like, oh, I bought this many houses or that many. Oh, let me tell you about these deals and that deal. Like, the loudest people are usually the ones that are most full of it.
Well, yeah, you want to be talking.
Well, I was just going to say, those are the ones that Homevestors really wants to put up on stage because, you know, they want to pump everybody
up. It makes for
up.
Good, like, theater. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It definitely makes for good theater.
Some of those guys really know what they're doing. Others, not as much. Mm-hmm. And if you're a volume shop and you want to feed the machine, then you have to do a lot of deals. Fine. Yeah. As long as that's your business and that's your skill set to run an office that has high volume, lower profits, but higher volume, I'd much rather run smaller volume, higher profits, solid deals, that kind of thing.
Talk a little bit about your partnership. I mean, what are the things you learned? A lot of people, when they get into real estate, partner with somebody, and maybe the business is going good or the business is going bad, and then you have these partnership issues. What are some lessons you learned through your partnership?
I was partners with Alan back then for probably 3 or 4 years or so, but he was pretty much a silent partner, which is one of the best kind of partners you can have. One of the things that worked best was the roles and responsibilities were clearly delineated and there was no overlap. So if there's one decision maker on this part of the project or what have you, there's one decision maker. And that's how it works right now, because I have a lot of partners on rental properties or financing or capital partners, I'll call them. They'll loan me money, whether they're friends or family or strangers. Their roles and responsibilities are very, very compartmentalized and defined. And that way, there's very little overlap. I have one partner who, there's a little bit of overlap still, because it's a partnership that's left over from a long time ago. We get along fine, but that little overlap at times, like, well, wait, who's responsible for this? And, like, I hate that. I hate saying this, have this person call. Like, no, it's either going to be him or it's going to be me, and that's it. Much
so having clearly
handle.
Defined roles and responsibilities. And I totally agree with that. I mean, this is probably a great time to do it day one. Don't wait until you're already in the throes of it or when things get stressful.
And put it in writing.
Yes.
I do it all the time. Even if it's an email, hey, this is what we've agreed to. I've got a guy I partner with now on deals where the whole deal is done in a handshake because we've done a lot of deals like this, but we still, even to this day, exchange emails. This is what we've agreed to. I'm going to do this. You're going to do that. I'm bringing this to the table. It's usually me bringing the deal to the table. He's going to help bring the financing. Then we'll split the work one way or another and I'll sell it. But it's very clearly defined and we have little problems with that. And since he's running the rehab, I'll want to give my 2 cents sometimes here and there. Sometimes he'll ask for it. But I know at the end of the day, I'm like, hey, that's his baby. Mm-hmm. If I don't like his choice of color for this or that, I'm like, hey, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut and just move on.
Another thing I always tell people is to plan the divorce before the marriage. So what does having a good buy-sell agreement or understanding what dissolution looks like? Because everybody's excited when you're about to get married and go on this journey of making all this money. And then nobody thinks about what the end looks like. And I think a lot of wise people will think about the end when they get started.
In fact, I have a story for that one because there was a guy I was partners with on a rental property. And then we had a falling out and we had everything in writing. I mean, this agreement was probably one of the best agreements I ever wrote up at the time when things were still fine. I mean, it was super detailed. In the event of this, this happened. I haven't gone to that level of specificity since then, but it worked out for this guy because we had a falling out, but we were still joined at the hip. And if we wanted to sell that property, we had to do X, Y, and Z or ABC. And that was it. We both agreed to it in writing and we just wound up sticking with it. And then we reconciled 3 or 4 years later, and we're on good terms again now, and we still own that property together and everything's fine. But that really, really good agreement was signed by both parties. That's the most important part. It was signed, not just the emails. It was signed. It was no like, well, you tacitly agreed to this by not responding to my email on that. You know,
right.
We didn't go down any of those rabbit holes. It was black and white. And that's what saved that property. It saved that relationship later on. So.
And you got through it. And that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything's not going to go perfect in business. It's certainly not in owning rental properties. So.
No, definitely not.
Talk about you fared as well as anybody through the 2007 through, call it 2010 recession. What do you think led to that? I mean, I kind of feel like we're headed to another recession or we're in another recession. What can people learn from you going through the last recession that they can apply today?
Sure. There's a couple things there. First, whatever we may or may not experience over the next 2 to 3 to 5 years or so, I don't think we'll ever be as bad, or in our lifetime, I should even say, we'll ever be as bad as what we experienced in 7, 8, 9 to 10.
Why? It was brutal. Me and Spencer
it was horrible.
I was going to bed every night crying. It was so bad.
We've lived through that one time, just like the Great Depression. We lived through that and people knew what to look out for. They've able to not repeat that. They were able to not repeat the stagflation from the 70s. All the devils were there for what became 2007 to 2010. Yeah. And we don't have those problems anymore. Right now, I mean, there were people, as everyone knows, there was lots of mortgage fraud, people buying houses with no doc loans. Couldn't afford it. First thing they let go. And they're not doing those sorts of things right now. And the houses, people that I'm seeing buying houses, those people are fairly liquid. They're making sure they have the down payments. Every once in a while, I'll see a down payment assistant type of thing pop up here and there, but not like it was before. I mean, it was rampant mortgage fraud. I mean, it was nuts. I was able to get through it because I would keep my head down. I'd keep my mouth shut. I just kept buying houses. And I would explain to people, as the market goes down, I'm not going to buy here where we are right now. I'm going to buy 2 steps ahead where the market's going to be in a month or two. And I don't know where that's going to be. So I flat out tell them I'm going to be conservative when I buy this thing. But they wanted to sell it so badly that they were fine with it because they just wanted to be done with it. The media, everything was all about panic and sell. You have to be done with it. And there was always a buyer out there. So I'd buy these houses and I'd collect. That's where I started collecting a bunch of the rental properties because when I buy a house for $10,000 or $20,000, when I got into this business in 2005, I'd buy a house from someone for like $70,000 or $80,000 and I'd look at the tax record and be like, holy cow, you paid $15,000 for this house in 1951? It was mind-blowing how little they paid for houses. And I couldn't get my head around it. And then all of a sudden, in 2009-10, I'm buying that same house for less than what that guy paid for it in the 50s. The guy paid like 10 or 15 grand. I paid $8,000 for that thing. So wasn't a huge market to sell it. And, you know, he probably could have sold it for another $5,000 or $10,000 markup. So I said, forget it. I'll just fix it up, hold it as a rental. And even if I never make a dime off this thing, it's going to cash flow like a monster. So I just started, that's when I really started buying the rental property.
And those were good houses, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Even solid really house. Solid, great houses were like fire sale, these areas.
Oh, yeah.
That was amazing.
I mean, people were just panicking. I had people on the phone just like, you have to buy this house. And I would tell them flat out, no, I don't want to buy your house. Like, it's not in an area I want. No, you have to make me an offer. This actually happened. The guy, super nice guy from Florida. He was an investor, bought a house in East Point, Atlanta. He was into the thing for way too much. He's just like, I'm over it. I was like, no, I can't do anything for you. I'm sorry. And I just kept, it was very Sandler sales in that I kept telling him no, and he just kept coming back. But I totally meant him. Like, I do not want to buy your house. I don't want to buy your house. I'm like, because he was such a nice guy and he was caught in a bind. I'm like, I'll do a $10,000 option for you where I'll buy it for $10,000. Anything I can mark up over 10, I get to keep kind of thing. And I'll pitch it to some investors I know. He's like, no, I just want you to buy it. Like, what if you were going to give me a number, what would you pay for it right now? I'll give you $1,000 for the thing. And he was into it for over $100,000. And he's like, fine, I'll take $1,000. I'm like, no, I was just kind of throwing a number out. He's like, no, you said $1,000, so you have to buy it for $1,000. So
it's like, a contract.
Fine. Yeah. So he came to town. He sold it to me for $1,000. He actually wound up bringing money to closing because there were some back taxes. I owner financed it to an investor for $14,000. Now the thing's worth like a small fortune, but I was just happy to get rid of it for $14,000 at the time.
Well, that brings up another question. Tell us about your most memorable deal.
Ooh, memorable deals. Wow, I've done hundreds and hundreds of deals. Not to toot my own horn, because every time someone talks about how, I've done
thousands.
Houses. Yeah, thousands. I immediately tune those people out. But I mean... I've been doing it since 2005, you know, 15 plus years later, it has to be hundreds or I wouldn't know what I'm doing. I mean, there've been several. I've bought a lot of cat pee and dog pee houses, bought a lot of those. That was very memorable because I learned a really important lesson. It was in my first year of doing this, I bought a cat pee house in Lilburn and I sold it to another investor right away. And I said, what are you going to do with all this stuff? It stinks. Like, and I was so new, I really didn't know what to do. She said, come by tomorrow, because I had to pull the lockbox off and whatnot. So she said, come by tomorrow, I'll show you what to do. I went by the house. She brought a lawn chair and a sign. And the sign said, everything in this house is free. And she put it outside and put one on the corner, sat in the lawn chair, drank her cup of coffee. And all of a sudden, everyone came out and they cleared that house out. And it stank so bad, I wouldn't even go in there. But they cleared it out because free is the magic word. And I've used that so many times since then. If I buy a house, like grandma's house, no one wants to take the older stuff. I put it on Craigslist or whatever it is. I say, everything in this house is free. I get rid of, as long as it's decent stuff and not even the best, but I mean, people take, hell, I did this 2 months ago. People took VHS tapes from Dean Martin's Celebrity Roasts. Who even has a VHS?
Right, player? Right.
Yeah, they take everything. It's great. In those houses, I don't even factor in cleaning it out, like a cleaning out fee, because I know it'll go away for free. There's houses where I fell through floors. There have been houses where, here's one. I bought a house in Decatur, and this is in my early days, and I had my home, I was still a home inspector. I was wearing my overalls. I was like crawling around in the crawl space because I want to check out every nook and cranny. My appointments back then were like 2 hours. I was overanalyzing the house. Like, poor sellers.
How long do they take now?
Seriously.
An hour, tops. And they probably don't even think I'm doing anything because I barely take notes at this point, because after a while, you know what you're looking at. Right. Back then, I was taking detailed notes and measurements. Those poor people. I was in the crawl space on my hands and knees, and the house was a ranch on a crawl space shaped like an L. And I came around the corner and I put my flashlight up and there was a mannequin like staring back at me. And it was the scariest thing. I popped up, smashed my head. Like, I was seeing stars. Like, oh man, that was very, very memorable. Very memorable. I bought a house up in Cartersville that was apparently owned by members of the KKK back in the day. That was pretty interesting. That was pretty nuts. But another one was another house where the entire first floor, and I'm talking the entire first floor, was covered in dog poop. I mean, it was unbelievable. So I don't remember the deals where I made the most necessarily. I remember the ones that stand out from the perspective of not being that normal kind of house where you could just go and waltz in, figure and paint and flooring, and that's that.
Well, I think from my experience back in those days, what you were looking for was that needle in the haystack, and you were really looking for the person with
deep motivation. Like they just wanted to get rid of that thing. And there was a number of reasons why they did. We bought a number of dog and cat stuff all over the place. And it's just amazing. Like people, when they get to a certain point, they're ready to just get rid of it.
And they'll let you know too. You don't have to do a hard sell on those. No, they will sit, they will sell you.
That's right.
And I would never, in any of these deals ever, if what they told me, because I always sit down and talk with these people ahead of time to better understand it. So, I mean, when people are buying houses that are listed, it's very different. But when you're getting called to go into a house and look at it, I mean, the first thing I'll do, I'll sit down and talk to them just to make sure I'm the right kind of buyer for them. Because if they give me any indication that they're not a real prospect for selling a house at a discount, I'll be the first one to recognize it. And I'll tell them, like, you don't need to sell to me. You don't need to sell anyone like me. You need to fix it up or you need to rent it out again. Because sometimes these people are just fishing or they just don't know any better. So they'll just call you. And if it's not the right solution, I mean, there's no house, you know, there's no deal that's worth, you know, trying to pull a fast one on somebody or to have bad karma on you like that. It's just not worth it. So, and what'll happen is you do that, and that person will refer you another deal down the road or something that's along those lines. And so there's no deal worth trying to do a sleight of hand kind of thing with them.
Well, that's the thing about real estate. You see a bunch of people get into this business and they kind of blow it right off the bat, trying to get too quick of success and taking advantage of people. Mm-hmm. And even in a place like Atlanta, it's too small. Like this community is too small. Word gets out way too fast. Mm-hmm. And if you want to build a long-term career in real estate, the first thing you don't do is start screwing people or taking advantage of people. You know, you build real estate on the back of reputation.
I completely agree. And that's actually one of the things I'm seeing now with the competition that's out there. We've got, you know, the corporate buyers that are out there, and then you've got the lots of independents that are out there right now. And a lot of these independent guys, they'll go to a weekend course or two and they might mean well, but they might be following what this guru told them. But you'll listen to some people say, just get it under contract. You could drop the price later, that type of thing. Just get it under contract, have the stipulations in there, and take these people. Essentially, you're taking them for a ride because you know
you're
going to be dropping the price on them later and you're not going to close. And, oh, I'm just bringing my inspectors through. No, they're not. They're other buyers. I mean, tell these people what you're doing because they're ruining it. They're kind of ruining some of these deals for everybody. And they're putting these sellers in really, really awkward positions. You know, and they'll just wear them down. Okay, well, I know I offered you 85 before, but I didn't notice that crack over there. And my finance guy said this, so now I'm going to offer you 79. And then they just keep whittling them down. And yeah, I know that's a tactic that some people will use. I would never, ever do that. I just think it's so disingenuous.
Yeah, it's dishonest. I mean, you know you're going to go down. And so you're not even having a real conversation with them on the front end.
Yeah, exactly. When I make my offers, I use a lot of earnest money to separate myself out for those types of people. I know what I'm looking at, so I don't need contingencies or anything along those lines. And if my number's $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 less, I'll explain why. And it's much harder to buy it at a much lower number. Those other guys are like, nah, I'll just give them 30 grand more, and then I'll just try and wear them down. And
yeah, bring it down. Yeah, well, you know, we see property management companies do that all the time. So we'll go out to a listing appointment and some other property manager promises them the world and we give them a more realistic idea of what it'll rent for, or even over the phone an idea of what it'll rent for. And they're already kind of sold on the bigger price just so they can get their sign in the yard. And they know they're just going to drop the price down to what market value is. There's nothing online that tells you that's going to rent for that price.
Mm-hmm. It is hard to unring that bell because these people will set expectations that are just unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go in there and try and explain to them what's actually going on and what the actual, now I'll pull out the comps, I'll show them everything. And they understand it intuitively, but then emotionally, they're still like, yeah, but that other offer is 20 grand.
They don't want to believe it. They want to believe the other number.
Yeah. They'll roll the dice. Well, and they'll say flat out, well, I'll give this guy a shot and then see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, I'll call you. I'm like, well, that's if I'm interested in your house at that time.
Hey, Ian, you know, you've talked a lot about how things have changed. I mean, we went through the recession 07, 08, all the way through 2010. When Matthew and I were in Homevestors and we were actively buying, things were a lot different. I mean, literally, we had billboards around town. We would get sometimes around 100 calls in a month. We'd make some offers. We'd buy some houses. But I mean, there's so much more competition. Talk to us a little bit about what it's like in Atlanta now, trying to find these deals, because we all have a lot of stories about these great deals. What's it like now trying to find those deals, and what are the most successful investors doing today?
Sure. Well, I can only speak to what I do on my side in terms of, because with Homevestors, we're still doing lots of mail. I believe we're on TV. We do billboards still, that type of stuff, lots of internet. what I see competitors doing is we have a pretty decent sized rental portfolio. They'll just see who owns it. I probably get between 20 and 30 at least postcards or letters per week from investors. And some of these things are pretty nice. I set them aside. I'm like, hey, if I ever want to send out postcards, you know, this is a nice
postcard. I'm going to copy that one.
Yeah. And other times they're absolutely dreadful spelling mistakes. I mean, you could just see where someone was just taken for a ride at a seminar of some sort to send out this junk letter. I get lots of phone calls and texts. We don't do that at HomeVestors, but I get lots of those. And I've heard that those can work pretty well. Although I think a lot of the low-hanging fruit in that those is gone by now.
I've gotten no less than 100 of those texts. In fact, I got one today. It has to, because it has to work the first time, because somebody needs to really think that somebody's texting them. Mm-hmm. At this point, you know it's some sort of automated bot that's sent out a bunch of texts.
Yeah, if you text back stop, it'll come back like, ooh, unsubscribe. Then once in a while, you get stop and someone actually texts you back and say, no, this is a real problem. I'm like, well, yeah. I'm still not interested in selling. But those texts and the phone calls seem to work, but I mean, it's fewer and farther between. I mean, I think for a good year or two, that was working because no one else was doing it. Now everyone and their grandmother and then their grandmother's neighbor's friends are doing it too. So it's, So I don't think it works nearly as well. Lots of letters and postcards. And then of course, you know, internet advertising where anyone can look as good or as bad as they want to be online.
Spencer used to tell the story when HomeVestors figured out direct mail. They were getting so many, because that was kind of the first group that figured out direct mail to buy houses. Mm-hmm. And Spencer tells the story, and maybe I should just let him tell him. Why don't you tell him the story about how many calls y'all were getting?
Well, what was interesting was Roland and I were kind of struggling. We're like, you know, these billboards are doing okay. They're bringing in these calls, but what are these guys in Atlanta doing? And I wish I could remember. You probably know the guys that we came over and we sat with. We spent a day. I'll never forget it. And they just said, this is what we're doing. We're doing direct mail. And we're like, that's it? And they were like, yes, that's it. So we went back, and this is before HomeVestors was doing any direct mail. And we put together our own direct mail. We found the most incredible cursive handwriting. I'm telling you, it fooled me. It was so good. And we just targeted one zip code, and man, we got so many calls. I mean, it was amazing. So that was probably 2005, 2006.
Yeah, it used to be the cost per lead back then was minimal.
It was nothing. Yeah, it was incredible.
Spencer used to tell everybody, I got so many calls, I would just answer the phone. You know, what's your address and how much do you owe?
That's right.
Not even say hi.
I mean, yeah, when you're getting 100 calls a month, you are just trying to get down to the people who are really motivated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's really competitive today. I mean, the cost per lead is through the roof, it sounds like. So finding good deals is really hard to do. Let's pretend I'm a new investor and I come to you, Ian, we're having lunch, and I say, how do I get started? What are some things I can do to get started in this business? What would be your advice for them?
My advice to them has never really... It's funny, I've had this conversation with so many people over the years, and I would always say, I'm going to tell you the same thing I would tell my brother. And then literally last month, my brother called me to ask me this question, and I started it out the same way. I'm going to tell you exactly what I tell my brother. He's like, what? I would tell newbies to focus on a small part of town that they know or they want to invest in and learn it really, really, really well, whether that's a zip code, whether that's a city. And if they don't like, after they start learning about it, they don't like it, they want to go somewhere else. Go somewhere else, but learn it. Like, just go there, drive it, get a real estate. If you're a real estate agent, obviously you can go onto the MLSs, but if you get a friend who lets you run searches for them or run searches for you, just look at those areas, know what things are selling for, and just start inspecting and looking at the houses yourself just to get an idea. You don't have to buy a damn thing, because you know the education part is free. You're not going to lose any money. You just learn and get out there. And once you start getting a really good grasp of what things are selling for, what level of finish and price points and this and that, then as deals pop up, you'll know immediately if that's a good deal or not. And you can then spend your time wisely picking that house. Okay, well, hang on a second. That's a little better. And you know it better than other people who are just buying blanket houses all over the place. Because a lot of the houses I buy, I will turn around and either fix them up. Let me take a step sideways so to put this all in context. When I buy houses, I will, first and foremost, if I can keep it as a rental, I'll keep it as a rental. If I can't, I'll look to see if I can wholesale it. And by wholesaling, I mean I'm going to put it on MLS. I'm an agent. I'll list it on MLS or FMLS here in Atlanta. I will list it and I will sell it, because a lot of those houses right now with what's going on in the market, it's supply and demand is really what's dictating the prices more than anything else. Back in the day, 2005 to 2008, there was so many shenanigans going on that you didn't know what was really dictating those prices, whether it be mortgage fraud or Lord knows what. But right now it's truly supply and demand, because you can see areas where there's very little inventory. And when you put a house on there, it'll just get bid up beyond asking price. And then you'll have your hands smacked by the appraiser who comes, you know, and says, hey, it's not worth that. I mean, this has happened 3 times over the past month. If it's a decent enough house where a handy homeowner can buy it, I'll put it out there and I'll sell it to them over an investor. Or I'll just, if I have the bandwidth, I'll fix it up and I'll turn around and sell it that way. But what'll happen is when I put these houses on the market, let's say it's an as-is house I'm selling, the investors who know the areas really well, they will spend the time, they'll go out there and they'll take a look at it really fast and they'll make an offer with really great terms and a very reasonable price. And I prefer to work with them versus the people who will make blind offers. Hey, you know, I'll give you a 1 day due diligence, but I haven't seen it. I'll go and I'll check the super logs to see if someone's actually looked at a house. Because if someone's made a blind offer, I mean, I'll put it in the listing, like don't even bother sending it to me. There's no shortage of buyers out there right now. And I want a legitimate person who knows what they're doing. If they want to go out there and take a look at it and they still want a very small due diligence, I'll be very specific. I'll ask them, like, what specifically about the house do you need to know more about? I mean, oh, I don't know if the heat and air is working. Okay, fine. No problem. Because I know if it's working or not. And if it's not, then I'll tell them flat out, it's not working. So factor that into your number and get back to me. Because a lot of people are being taught to make blind offers on things and then just walking away. And you just waste so much time and you burn so many bridges. I've got a blackball list of agents who I won't work with anymore, because I flat out ask them, like, is this a blind offer? No. I looked at it with my client. And then a day later, they go out there, or 2 days later, they'll pull their offer. I'm like, well, what was it? Oh, the rehab was too big. And you couldn't tell that when you first went there? I mean, right. That just drives me up the wall.
Right.
So to come full circle to your question, what would I tell somebody? Don't be that guy. You know, yeah. Be the person who understands values in the neighborhood, the cost of repairs, that type of stuff. Even running through houses that you have no intention of making an offer on, you can still go through and say, okay, if I was going to rehab this house, what would I do to it? You know, how do I analyze this deal? Does it make sense? Does it not make sense? If it starts to sit on the market longer, then you can maybe revisit it later and say, hey, look, I remember this house from before. I can make you an offer like this, and have that offer really separate itself. So, and you do that by focusing on one or two small parts of town, knowing them, understanding them. That way you can also, you could do letters to those neighborhoods for, and it won't cost you a small fortune. And when you're talking to those sellers, they'll know if you know the neighborhood. I mean, you can't just say, oh yeah, I bought a house on Main Street over there. Like when you start talking about the neighborhood, they'll know because they live there. They've been there for a long time. So you can ingratiate yourself with them that way. And then when the time comes to sell the houses, there's some, as everyone knows, there's lots of agents who work the same neighborhoods over and over again. So you can establish relationships there. So that would be my advice. Find an area that you like, or maybe just two areas. Because I know some people, and I'll do it too, where I buy certain houses for appreciation and other houses for cash flow. And I just kind of offset the portfolio and balance the portfolio that way. I'll look at a house and be like, you know what? I'm not going to cash flow much, but man, in 10 years, this area is going to be great. So I'm okay earning $100 or $200 a month. Whereas in a worse part, it's kind of wouldn't touch a house cash flowing that based on the other opportunities I could find.
And this may be just the inverse of what you just said, but what are some mistakes you see new investors make that are pretty easy to avoid?
To me, it's that, it's not to belabor the point, but it's those blind offers and knowing that you're going to just try and drop the price later. You just wind up pissing off a lot of people. I just got a house last week where I know I was $20,000 below the next offer, but my terms were so much better. He flat out told me, he's like, look, you're at this number. Can you come up? You have any wiggle room? And I really didn't, because my terms were zero due diligence, none. I knew what I was looking at. I knew the values. I knew what I was doing. And the seller was a more sophisticated seller. So he understood the value of the terms that I was offering, and he had to explain that to his clients. If it's a completely newbie agent or a newbie seller, they might not understand how valuable good terms are. You know, no due diligence, no financing, no inspection contingency, no appraisal contingency, nothing. Just come in with a decent amount of earnest money. What's that?
It's a done deal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, is it a killer home run deal for me? No, but it's a solid deal. But my number was my number. I stuck to it. I couldn't come up. and he understood the value there, and he made the deal happen.
So, how many houses do you look at a week?
Right now, not a tremendous amount because I've got an employee who does a lot of that. Right now, I'm working on kind of managing the rehabs and trying to turn the rentals as much as I can because I wear two hats, the flipping rehab hat and then the rental manager hat as well.
And changing locks. You also
do locks. I have friends that just make fun of me because of it. I'm like, all right, fine, whatever.
Do you still drive the red truck?
No. I had a bus full of old people pull in front of me on a rainy day and I hit the side of it. So, that was a couple of years ago. Wasn't my fault. It was rainy and they just literally just pulled right in front of me. A guy said, yeah, I saw you. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I did it anyway. I had a Toyota Tacoma. I actually just wound up getting a new one finally, a new truck. Well, not new to me.
Nice. We deal with a lot of out-of-state investors. Are there some areas that you would say, hey, these are kind of areas that I would target if I'm an out-of-state investor, whether that's somebody buying a turnkey home or somebody looking to invest in an area? And think rental property too.
Yeah.
Most out-of-state investors want rental homes.
I mean, I'm pretty bullish on Atlanta in general. There's pretty much...
Why?
Why? Because I think it's got a lot of potential. It's a growing state. I think it's run fairly well. Lots of people are moving here. Lots of businesses and large companies have relocated to Atlanta and reestablished their headquarters and whatnot. So it's definitely a growing city and it just sprawls out. I mean, it's a good question. There's no part of town, honestly, there's no part of town I would not buy houses in and rent them out. But I'm not your average landlord either. What I see move the fastest and move the best are the ones with good schools. I mean, that's nothing new. A lot of people know that. And it also, again, it also depends if you're going for appreciation or cash flow, like I was talking about before. Right. There's definitely some stuff on the south side of town that's very blue collar. Some of my best renters and rentals are down there that I've had these people for 10 years in these houses. I would bend over backwards and do anything for them. They say flat out, we never want to move. Great. Any problem you have, I will take care of. And will that house appreciate more than what I paid for it? Not a tremendous amount, but man, that's going to cash flow really well. Whereas another house that I just bought, like I was talking about, I know it's not going to cash flow, but it's a longer term appreciation play. The super popular parts of town when people are saying, hey, everyone's buying over here. I've seen that not work out a lot. Well, this has not worked out well for a lot of people only because things just tend to get bid up in those parts of town. And you wind up paying more than you really should. And you just have to be very disciplined and not overpay for certain things just because you want to get a house. Just be patient. There will always be plenty of houses. Trust the numbers, whether it's you're doing a rental analysis or the property manager is doing the rental analysis. I mean, there's parts of town where I can't quite figure out what's going on. So I'll call a couple friends who have properties there or run property management company. They'll say, tell me about this area. What do you know? What kind of rent can I actually expect? And if they tell me, like, no, there's one area, it was a neighborhood where one side of the street was just that much better than the other. It was the elementary school. Same high school. So when I looked online, it was like the same high school, but it was a different elementary school. And that made all the difference in this one neighborhood. I didn't even think of looking at that at the time. But Patrick's like, no, I know this neighborhood. You have to do not pay this because you're not going to get that kind of rent. People will pay more to be in this neighborhood. And if you ever looked at a district for elementary schools, they're very, very strange. They're not like rectangular blocks on a map. It's very, very strange. If you don't know exactly what you're looking at, you can forget it. So definitely seek the advice of someone who knows what they're looking at. Yeah, I was pretty seasoned at that time too, but I still couldn't figure it out.
Well, that gets back to being an expert in one area, right? So you would know where the elementary school stops and starts. We've made a lot of mistakes around high schools. And, you know, we made one that comes to mind all the time where we have two houses we were trying to rent. Like the whole neighborhood was in one, but this little half side of one street was in some other, which was the less desirable area. And then all of a sudden we got into some trouble just because we assumed. But that gets back to your thoughts on being an expert in one specific area. So you know those types of things.
And another thing, I almost started going down this path when I first joined Homevestors and started becoming a real estate investor. And I've seen a lot of people do it over the years, which is they start like chasing after the shiny things. And like, well, hey, have you heard of tax deeds? Or what about this? Or what about, I mean, and they just like, wow, that seems, the grass is so much greener, so much easier. What, I could buy probate? I could do that. And they just start chasing after different things and they never master one of them. And they just wind up chasing their tails and wasting so much time doing that. And so when I first started, and for the first bunch of years, all I did was buy and sell just to learn and get down the mechanics. of learning how to buy and sell, because you could do so many things right. You can buy it right, you can value it, you can manage your property right, you can manage the rehab right or whatever it is. But if you can't sell it right or you don't know its value, there's just so many things that you have to do correctly that if you don't do them all right, then you're not making a lot of money on that thing. So you just have to do and churn a lot of deals to learn the mechanics of that type of stuff. And I learned in the beginning, I mean, there's just a bunch of different ways to skin a cat. And there are certain deals, if you didn't have that skill set of how to figure out how to make it work, you weren't going to make any money. Although there is something to be said for in the first, you know, handful of deals, if you make no money, you've made money. Because you not only did you not lose it, but you just got a free education. Yeah, and I can't tell you how valuable that is. I mean, that people tell you don't rehab your way out of a bad buy. You know, I learned that mistake. And man, that was a very, very expensive mistake.
Well, I've heard of a great strategy getting in is to find a seasoned investor like you. I'm not offering your services up, but you know, if I find the house and I have the money and I basically run it by you and then splitting the profit with you, I mean, that's something that a lot of seasoned investors will do, basically just use their knowledge. You found the house, you're supplying the money to buy that house, and then you're getting the education. And yeah, a seasoned investor is going to save you as much money as they make on that deal.
Yeah, I've done deals like that. And I still do that with other investors where I come across a deal and I know, yes, I could do this myself, but I don't have the bandwidth for it. So instead of doing multiple things half-assed, I just like to do a couple things half-assed. So I can't do a lot of things half-assed. So I will maturely say, I can't take it on, but I know there's something there. So I will bring the deal to another investor and I'll partner with them on it. I still do that. And people will bring me deals and I'll, especially newer investors, I've done that several times with new investors, and I'll walk them through, I'll show them my paperwork, I'll show them all that stuff and how I do it.
That's awesome. I think that's a great place to wrap it up. Ian, this has been great. It's great to connect with you. I know people are going to enjoy getting to learn from one of the masters in Atlanta. So thanks so much for spending the time with us.
Sure. I appreciate you guys having me on today.
All right, everybody. This wraps up this episode of the Atlanta Real Estate Investor. If you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe to our channel and look for us. We'll be releasing episodes probably about every 2 weeks. So look forward to new episodes coming.
And give us an honest review.
Yes, please. All right.